I like to work, so I just assume get started.
Doesn't
bother Protestant ethic, right? And as we'll see, Dag Hammarskjöld had the very much the Protestant ethic too, and that was his whole life, in fact. So let's start off, and let me say just a couple of words, first of all, about what I hope we can do in here for these three periods today, tomorrow, and Thursday at this particular hour, and then get into discussion and sharing as quickly as possible. 2 years ago, a book by a professor at one of the Pacific seminaries came out, James William McClendon, Biography of Theology, and then How Life Stories Can Remake Today's Theology, which is available in the bookstore here. They asked us ahead of time for books, to recommend books, which we'll be talking about. And I want to use three or four of the chapters in these three periods, which are covered in the McClendon book. It's a rather new and novel kind of approach to understanding not only theology as a, you know, as an interesting subject in and of itself, but understanding also how the life stories of these individuals whom we'll be talking about in here can serve as a focus for, if you like, inspiration and guidance, direction, correction for our own lives. The plan that McClendon uses is to have a sort of a general opening statement as to what we can learn about theology and about God's presence in our world and how we respond to that presence through the life stories of four specific individuals whom he takes up in order. And the one we'll have today, Dag Hammarskjöld, and tomorrow, Martin Luther King. Then on Thursday, Clarence Jordan. Probably very few of you know who Clarence Jordan is, but hopefully you'll be around on Thursday to find out. A very interesting man who was formed one of the first interracial communities down in Koinonia, in fact, in Americus, Georgia, where they have lived as a community, self-sufficient economically for a long time, providing a very strong and remarkable Christian witness. The one we don't have time to go into in here is a fourth individual whom some of you, I'm sure, know, Charles Ives, the American composer, who has a very interesting life story as an expression of his particular religious faith. And I would hope that if some of you are interested in this, you would, you know, buy the book and read it yourself for I think, the real benefits and the insights and kind of the excitement that go along with this. Because it's a different kind of approach. We don't start off with simply, you know, learning, you know, large, rather sometimes abstract, metaphysical or theoretical principles, you know, when sometimes it gets a little bit dull, and this is my own particular feeling. I think rather almost all of us are mostly interested in people, and we start with people rather than starting, you know, with huge big doctrines, which you know sort of come down to us. I always remember the marvelous statement that it'll come to me, for goodness sake. I lectured on him. Walter Rauschenbusch, for goodness sake. The founder of the social gospel movement in America. And after he had been out in the world, he reflected back on his theological education. And he said, we tiptoed during theological education, he said, we tiptoed from one absolute to the next. We sort of looked over here, you know, at virgin birth, and looked over here at Trinity, and looked over here at atonement, like they were some finished final products, incomplete, you know, of themselves, where you sort of stood and gazed like you would at Mount Rushmore or something, and everybody oohed and aahed, and there was nothing that happened, nothing that changed, nothing that moved, because of just looking at these big monuments or these absolutes. Whereas if you start from the other end, instead of starting from the general and going to the specific, if you start from the specific and with specific life stories, then you can draw from life stories. I mean, you can raise certain questions with life stories as to why these people, you know, acted and behaved in the way they did. What kind of convictions did they have? What kind of beliefs did they have which motivated them to do the things that they did? And out of this, you can start to draw some, you know, generalizations, some general meanings and patterns as to the meaning of religious faith in the lives of these specific individuals. But I think for my own self, I mean, you know, it's just one way of doing it. It isn't the only way, and McClendon doesn't say it's the only way. It's one way of doing it because it becomes much more real and personal to us rather than simply gazing in awe at what, you know, has been handed down to us for 19 centuries or probably since medieval Catholic times. That's when sort of theology, such as we understand it, came into its present focus. So what I would like then is to look at some of these life stories And then ask you yourselves for your response to these, and maybe we can share and discuss some of the ideas and learn a little bit from them. I want to say just a couple of things about McClendon's approach, and then a couple of things about Hammarskjöld, and then we can hopefully get started on this. Now, McClendon argues that every person, obviously some of these are just, you know, truisms, but we start from the easy and then probably move to the more complex, that every person has his own distinct personality and character which makes him or her different, you know, obviously from anybody else. And the way in which you learn to know how what a person is and how he or she is alike and how he or she is different from other people is to look at the way in which, you know, they behave, not only sort of what they profess, but actually how they behave, how they act, how they act in small groups and large groups, how they act in all kinds of different kinds of situations. And from their behavior, we learn what their convictions are. We learn what they believe are the most important things in life, what they choose to defend, what they choose to stand by, what they choose to evaluate, and what they choose to discard. But what we learn from others, and when we learn from our own reflection on ourselves, of course, is the fact that we do have various convictions. We do have various ideals, if you like, and values which we consider to be important, and which we will try to either preserve or advance or modify under the own certain kinds of stress situations. All right. And not only do individuals have convictions which motivate the way they behave, but obviously larger groups, social groups, do also. That it isn't just a matter of individuals behaving in a certain way, but we have all kinds of different communities which reflect certain ideas and values and convictions, if you like, which give us a clue as to understanding, you know, why they behave the way they do. Probably the best example I can give here is one which is very, you know, immediate to all of us. And that is, if you look at any given, you know, society, if you like, or any given nation as a form of community, you will see that they have slightly different forms of what we would call public law. No two nations in the world have quite the same, you know, system of justice. In some there is more concern with the rights of individuals than others. In some there is less. And from what I learned from last week before, you know, the world suddenly disappeared, was India was, moving in a certain other kind of direction altogether. I don't know if it's still that way. Yeah, things move so quickly there. But it gives us some clue and insight into, you know, what kind of convictions motivate the people there and why people respond the way they do to this sort of thing. All right. So we have just basically the idea that McClendon says, we have the stuff for understanding theology by looking at the specific ways in which, you know, people, ourselves and others, behave under certain kinds of situations. All right. Now, the question then becomes, you know, which individuals do we want to look at in some detail? Which individuals seem to offer us clues, ideas as to why they acted the way they did, why they responded the way they did, what motivated them? What is there in their particular response to certain situations that is significant and important, you know, for us? Why do we remember some people? Why do we pick out certain individuals, you know, and not others? So, because we all do. I want to read just very briefly here from McClendon's explanation as to why certain individuals, should be cited or picked out for special examination. He said, "In or near the community, there appear from time to time singular or striking lives, the lives of persons who embody the convictions of the community, but in a new way, who share the vision of the community, but with new scope or power, who exhibit the style of the community, but with significant differences. It is patent that the example of these lives may serve to disclose and perhaps to correct or enlarge the community's moral vision." That's an idea I like, that by looking at certain individuals, you can somehow, your vision of understanding is enlarged, because you see individuals who in a very real sense are somewhat larger than life, because certainly Dag Hammarskjöld is larger than life, larger, you know, than the rest of us. And the other people that I'll be talking about are this too. These people tend to can correct or enlarge the community's moral vision, at the same time arousing impotent wills within the community to a better fulfillment of the vision already acquired. In other words, they don't only give us, you know, a larger vision, but they can motivate us to do something better ourselves, to live a better life, to recognize that there are resources within us that haven't been tapped. And oftentimes I think, Bobby, I'll be repeating myself when I say this again later, we feel more closely, I mean, we feel more strongly motivated because it's other human beings who are doing these things. It isn't just some abstract ideal out there, you know, we all should strive for justice, that's not fine, or love or brotherhood. That's very nice, and we can work out all kinds of nice definitions about brotherhood and love and justice and, you know, all these things, but unless we see it specifically in the lives of other people, it remains pretty much simply, you know, something for the blackboard or something for the classroom rather than something specific and immediate in our lives. And I think all of us have known people who, you know, who help bring out the best in us rather than oftentimes the worst with us. All right. Yeah, this is a point he's making. But the same example may serve also to stir up other convictions of the community. Its understanding of God, its doctrine of man, its appreciation of the earth and all that is in it. These convictions, too, may be gated or enlarged, altered and reinforced by the lives of such significant persons. Such lives, by their very attractiveness or beauty, may serve as data for the Christian thinker, enabling him to more truly reflect upon the tensions between what is and what ought to be and ought to be believed and lived by all. To engage in such reflection, however, is the proper task of Christian theology. That the task can be fulfilled in this way is a theme of the present book. What can we learn, in other words, about the presence of God's will in our lives and in the lives of others by looking at the lives of certain specific individuals who are, as we say, in this particular sense, larger than life itself? McClendon goes on to point out that we have the supreme example of he says we have the supreme example of biography as theology in the person of Jesus himself. His Christianity is very much a biographical, you know, religion, because Christianity rises or falls, succeeds or fails on the basis of the life and the ministry and the meaning of Jesus. And what we look for there is not any sort of systematic theology in the life of Jesus, because you certainly won't find it. But you'll find the life of Jesus, which has served as, you know, a tremendous magnet attraction for all who have known of his life over these 19 centuries. And it has been other people who have made theologies and confessions and creeds and doctrines. It wasn't Jesus himself. I know I can give an example here. Our college just put on the musical Godspell, and I was a proud parent, and I became what you would call a groupie. I guess that's the ones who follow these things around, and the cast with my son, and it went on the road for 3 weeks in southern Minnesota and Wisconsin and so on, and I was completely stage struck, maybe fulfilling, whatever reason, you know, fulfilling myself through my son, I don't care what it was, I just went and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and so I got to know the play very well. In fact, 5 times, you know, that's a trend, you know, in 3 weeks you say the same show 5 times. And I'd go again. And my daughter, you know, she wanted to go every time. She wanted to drive out to Green Bay, Wisconsin. And it was a terrible time talking to her. We just couldn't do it. But, you know, she would have done it. But anyway, in Godspell, as some of you know, it's a reenactment of the Gospel of St. Matthew. And what struck me so often, and I was sort of thinking about preparing these lectures when I was going to Godspell too, was how very personal and immediate the parables and the lessons were that Jesus taught, especially the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes and all of those which go with them. Nothing, in a sense, which could be considered abstract or vague or unrealistic, but all very lifelike situations, because Jesus was talking not to, you know, academic professors, and I'm not knocking them because, you know, I like to consider myself one, but he was talking to people who could best understand what the kingdom of God was like through very simple, you know, realistic, lifelike situations. You find this, of course, in John, too, the famous, you know, I am concept in John, the good shepherd, the true vine, all of these things which made sense to people in days in terms of, you know, their everyday lives. And then from that on, others, obviously, such as Paul and others, abstracted and drew, you know, rather formal theological statements from this. But Jesus serves, you see, as the supreme personal example of biography as theology. That's all I'm saying. All right. Now the question becomes, well, if we have that example, do we need any others? Why bother with the lives of other people if we have the supreme example in the person of Jesus as exemplary of what the will of God should be for all of us, what the ministry of Jesus has done for all of us? McClendon makes a point, and I think it's right, that we aren't saying by looking at other people that they are, you know, in anywhere near the same plane as the life of Jesus, But we need fresh examples. We need fresh models to show us what Christianity means to us today. It's very difficult at times, and you know how difficult it is when you start, you know, trying to draw specific lessons about what would Jesus say about, let's say, you know, certain specific legislation. You get into that gun control or something. That's always a good one to stir up emotions. What would Jesus say? And of course, you get all kinds of different opinions there, and so on. So we have, you know, one approach by looking at the life of Jesus, but we need fresh examples to show us what Christianity means to us today in specific life-like concrete, you know, situations. And what we find then in the lives of certain individuals, such as we'll be talking about here, is that we have this resource available for us. Because each of the individuals, and we you know, everybody could draw up his own list. It'd be interesting if each of you would draw up your own list of people whose lives have meant, you know, something very significant to you, and ask yourself why. Every year, remember, on New Year's, Gallup always takes a poll about the 10 most admired this and that and so on. And it's always very interesting, you know, why certain people are, you know, picked. And of course, people were moving in and out of Washington so fast, you know, the last few years that they had their, it was difficult for Gallup to keep up, you know, on because oftentimes just by being in the public eye, you were popular, but some of them hit the skids in a hurry. I must say, all right, anyway, what we have is in certain individuals, the vision that, or the understanding that they made a visible difference, you know, in this life. I think that's one of the criteria for our choosing people like Doug Hammarskjöld and Jordan and Martin Luther King also. That because of their lives, our world is somewhat different. Our world is remarkably different in if you follow these people rather carefully, because of the kind of lives they lived and because of the kind of motivation which prompted, I think, them to behave and act in the way that they did. And therefore, when we look at individuals as to give us clues and understanding as to what the will of God in our lives should be, then we want to look at individuals who made a significant difference, who made an impact, who we can say did change things. And each in their own way, as I'll try to talk about here, did do this. And I would encourage you also, if you have a chance, to read some of the chapters in here for discussion, and I think it would help for us if you were able to share some of your reflections and responses to McLennan also on this. And then finally, one last point, then we'll start on Hammarskjöld. I think it would be very helpful for all of us to ask ourselves, do each or any of these have anything, you know, to say to us specifically today? That is, that we should hold up the convictions of each of these particular individuals to us, and we should look at them not as interesting individuals. I mean, I could go through the whole thing from as a history teacher and show from a historical standpoint, you know, how much of a difference they made. And everybody could sit back and, isn't that interesting and isn't that a nice story? And, you know, you'd let it go at that. It hasn't touched any of us in any kind of personal sense. And it would be a very, you know, significant sort of thing. That's such a loaded, you know, and meaningless word. In that sense, but I would hope that we could all hold up these individuals to our own convictions and our own beliefs and ask ourselves, do they present, you know, an option to us today that is in any way viable or usable for us? And if they do, you know, why? And if they don't, you know, offer us these kind of resources, then we'd ask ourselves that question also. Why not? Why isn't the vision of somebody like Hammarskjöld or Jordan or whomever, you know, really satisfactory for us today? And I think it'll would help us very much in understanding this whole idea of biography of theology. All right, now, with that in mind, let me start off just very briefly on Hammarskjöld, because I want to get into the ideas and the discussion as quickly as possible with this. And we take Dag Hammarskjöld because here was a man who, by the standards of the world, of judging individuals, had as much, if not more, actual, downright, simple, naked power in his hands than anyone else. Here was a man who we have to take seriously because his credentials are in order. For some people here, you may have forgotten that he was Secretary General of the United Nations, or Secretary General of the United Nations from 1953 till his untimely death in the Congo in 1960. In that particular position, he had, you know, enormous influence over the course of world events. And we are, I'm not going to go into sort of a historical lecture here on the specific things that he did do, but suffice it to say that I think the world owes a great deal to Hammarskjöld for his vision, his dedication, and the kind of leadership that he gave to the world at that particular time, in a very difficult, in a world which is so different from ours today, because there were so many more world tensions at that time which we don't have today. Furthermore, Hammarskjöld should be taken seriously because he had a first-rate mind. There's no question that he could have had a very distinguished career if he had stayed in the academic world. He did get a PhD. He could have had a very distinguished career if he had stayed in civil service. He was a very active, successful participant in the world of domestic affairs in Sweden before he became attached to the United Nations mission, and then moved on, of course, and others quickly saw the enormous capacity and ability of this particular individual, and he was moved into the Secretariat General position, and there made his great contribution, of course, to world peace. All right. Now, one last introductory thing, and then we'll go into his ideas. Nobody knew, really not even his closest friends knew, that here was a man in his mature years who was grappling personally, and on a very solitary, I suppose you could say, way, with the great fundamental religious issues facing himself and facing the world. Some people have been bothered by this because they say, if he was so committed a believer, why didn't it show in his life? Why didn't he go out and sort of testify or witness or something with this? Hammarskjöld himself kept at least kept his religious faith very much to himself, by contrast to some evangelists, for instance. Because as the head administrative officer of the United Nations, he recognized that demanded a certain code of behavior which preempted all other considerations. That is, he couldn't show any favoritism to any organized religious body, because he was there to represent all of the United Nations. And if he were to come out supporting one particular organized religious body, he might lose the support and the cooperation of all the others, because the United Nations just isn't, Christians and Jews, but there's, Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and all the rest. And so Hammarskjöld had to be absolutely nonpartisan. And this he managed to do. He did it so well that people were surprised that when they found his famous writings, or as they were called, the markings, they found a man of very strong religious convictions. And some people, as I say, have been bothered by this, but I think when you look at the kind of values that Hammarskjöld himself upheld, that he did the right thing. But after his death, in his apartment in New York, some of his friends found a manuscript of some 200 pages that he had been keeping a diary, and which is best titled or translated from the Swedish as markings, reflections on the great issues of the day. And in that, we have sort of the spiritual autobiography of one of the most remarkable individuals in our day. And I would strongly recommend, if you have the chance sometime, to read this. It's an excellent insight into a man, as I say, who we have to take very seriously, because he's not just one more kind of official, but a man who was at the very center of controversy and influence for a long period of time. All right. So what do we learn about Dag Hammarskjöld's religious faith? What do we learn from his biography about his particular theology? What kinds of questions and considerations are raised for us from the kinds of convictions and behaviors that Hammarskjöld professed? Why should we bother, in other words, with Hammarskjöld himself for this? I think that the clue to Hammarskjöld, and I just want to talk a little bit more about this just to get it focused, is that Hammarskjöld grew up in a traditional fashion in which, and of course in Sweden there was a state church, in which he had the best religious education which is available at that time. On his mother's side, his relatives were all of the clergy, and his father's side, he happened to be a civil service and so on. But he had the best kind of theological education available. Yet when he went off in early adulthood, his explicit religious faith sort of disappeared, and he never became hostile or antagonistic, but he simply couldn't find any kinds of satisfactory permanent answers to the great questions which kept nagging him. And it was all through his middle years that he was plagued with all sorts of very deep, profound questions that he couldn't answer. And this is the more remarkable, because here was a man whom you would think would have everything going for him. I mean, you would think that being Secretary General of the United Nations would offer you, you know, enough to do so that you wouldn't have to, you know, to wonder about the meaning and purpose and direction of life. And yet, Hammarskjöld himself found a great emptiness, a great void, a great puzzle or predicament, because he wanted to believe, he wanted to be sure that what he was doing was rooted in a strong, growing religious faith, and yet he couldn't for such a long period of time actually bring himself to affirm the validity of his faith. But here's the clue with I think with Hammarskjöld, and the one I would like to talk about here just for a moment, is that Hammarskjöld didn't wait to become involved in working for world peace and all that's connected with this. He didn't wait for that until he had been, how should I say this, until he had come to a strong, mature religious faith himself. There are those, in other words, who would go to, let's say, theology and would look at the great teachings and the great doctrines, for instance, of the Christian faith in this particular case, and would be convinced on the basis of the insights of Christian teachings that this is Christianity is indeed true, that what we call a Christian worldview is indeed sound and right and good for me, and therefore now that I have accepted Christian faith as the, you know, as the true way, I will behave in a certain way, and I will conduct myself, and I will find meaning and purpose and direction in life which I didn't have before. Hammarskjöld didn't do that at all. Hammarskjöld himself never came back to a position after his agnostic days of full commitment to any specific religious tradition or denomination at all. Although he wasn't critical, and he didn't deny the place of the church. In fact, oftentimes, as McClendon shows, he attended church a great deal as a form of refreshment and for his very busy life and some of his deep questions. But Hammarskjöld, this is the point. Hammarskjöld acted as if what he was doing was in harmony with, you know, the religious convictions. He couldn't bring himself to state for a long period of time that yes, indeed, the idea that a life of service to God is the most fulfilling life one can have. He didn't believe that for a long time, but he didn't let him paralyze, you know, his own specific actions. What I'm saying is that he acted as if Christianity was true. That's the point. He acted as if Christianity was true, even though he wasn't sure himself that it was true. He wasn't super critical on the one hand, but yet he was, you know, a long way from persuaded about it for a long period of time. He wanted, in other words, to find a religious justification for what he was doing, because his life was one of a public servant, and he always saw himself as a servant. In a way, there is sort of a messianic undercurrent here in a life of being, you know, a man for others, because he would work 18, 20 hours a day, and he had no private life of his own. He never married. He devoted as much time as possible, as much time as he could stay awake to his work. And for a long period of time, he did this simply not really knowing why he did it. But it was sort of expected of him. He thought there was something right about the kind of life of dedication and service to others that was important to him. But he wasn't really convinced that this was the kind of life which was expected of him on the basis of his religious convictions himself. And so he kept on working. He kept on in his position, but always asking questions until, as McClendon shows, he reached, obviously, some sort of a crisis in his life in 1952 and early 1953. And let me explain this, and then we'll see where we go from there. It had been his custom at New Year's to go back to Sweden and go up into a Swedish mountain cabin, and there talking, reading, thinking, as McClendon mentions here. It had been his custom for several years to make the first entry in his journal for that year by quoting a line from a solemn hymn, which his mother had customarily read to her family on New Year's Eve. And then the first line of this hymn goes, "How vain the worldling's pomp and show, the night approaches now." Hammarskjöld would then add a journal meditation of his own. These meditations had been characteristically melancholy. 1951, "The night approaches now." And if this day should be your last in 1952, the night approaches now, how long the road is. These were indications or writings of a man who was searching, who was looking, but who hadn't really found, so to speak, satisfaction or meaning in the kind of life and the kind of service that he was giving to others. But 1953 is different. The 1953 New Year's entry again quotes a hymn, but what follows is different. The night approaches now, and then here's where the difference comes in. For all that has been, thanks. For all that shall be, yes. Now, McClendon and others interpret this particular passage to be a recognition by Dag Hammarskjöld that he had finally come to recognize that his life owed its source and its meaning to a power above and beyond himself. Now, McClendon and others interpret this particular passage to be a recognition by Dag Hammarskjöld that he had finally come to recognize that his life owed its source and its meaning to a power above and beyond himself, that there was importance and significance not only for living according to, you know, the expectations of others as to what one should do in terms of hard work and dedication and self-sacrifice and all these things, but in terms of understanding that the way in which one found meaning and significance and direction and purpose in life was through the idea of a totally selfless, dedicated servant. And once Hammarskjöld had come to accept the fact that his life and the explanation of the meaning in his life rested in a power above and beyond himself, then the doubts, the fears, the emptiness which he had known, you know, disappeared. And disappeared not instantly, but over a period of time that you can trace in the journal, disappeared rather clearly by after about 2 years after this famous statement when he said, to all that shall be, yes. In other words, there was something meaningful and significant in his life to look forward to have confidence that there would be, you know, ultimate explanation sometime as to what he was doing, even though now it seemed as though so much of it, so much meaning seemed to be so distant and so very hard to understand on this. So what I'm suggesting here is that we talk, if you like, about whether or not a faith such as Hammarskjöld's, you know, is adequate for our times. Because what he is saying is that although we don't really, or we aren't really able to, how should I say this, give full, complete explanation, nor are we able to reach a complete, clear understanding of why we act the way we do so oftentimes simply by what he would call the leap of faith. And until the leap of faith is made, there will be the kinds of emptiness and frustration that he found. But even though one cannot be convinced from what we would call, I suppose, an intellectual basis, that the leap of faith is going to someday clarify, you know, all the great questions and riddles in life, we make the leap of faith nevertheless. And that the leap of faith really comes down to the final affirmation of what, you know, faith is all about. And that to Hammarskjöld is enough. That's the question that I want to raise with you. Is this enough? This kind of trusting leap of faith, which doesn't answer the questions, but what she is saying is better than anything else at the time. The final point that McClendon makes, just to sum up then, is that if we're looking for biography of theology, we see in the life and the convictions of a man like Hammarskjöld what the concept of a totally dedicated, selfless pilgrim and servant, you know, should be in this world. And that tells us something about the grace of God, because obviously Hammarskjöld felt under this kind of, you know, direction.
Are you ready for the...
Sure, I'd be delighted.
I read a portion of, I have markings at home, and one that you don't sit down and read, just by the hour, you read portions of it. I was impressed in there that maybe I got into the part where his, before his book became solidified, that he was very definitely groping, and that he was he appeared to me as a more of a mystic and than a believer, and that he was a troubled man, and you get the impression that he's a lonely man.
Very much.
That he didn't have anybody really he could confide in, and that I was surprised the choice of Hammarskjöld, you know, in that biography, in the setting of that book right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no, he quotes the mystics a lot, and there's no question that he finds them more congenial to some of his needs than, you know, explicit, you know, step-by-step systematic theologians to answering the great question. And there's no question that he put a great deal of emphasis on inner convictions and on what we would call more personal, if you like, subjective searching and understanding for, you know, the great questions or explanations, I should say, to life, and that he felt quite comfortable with the mystics.
He seemed like my impression there, and what else, that he could fit into a Unitarianism in the search for truth more than into Christianity or Hebraism, where it was defined. He seemed like he was groping for something elusive that he couldn't quite reach it there.
Yep.
I wonder. I'm always troubled by the closing. Could you put it where you talked about retracing the landscape?
This is 1953. You mean the time of affirmation?
No. At the very end, somewhere he's talking about this journey. He begins to recognize the landscape again. He's been here before.
Oh yeah,
I can't remember the chapter or verse, but it's out towards the end, and it's kind of, you know, his origins were strongly.
Swedish Lutheran.
Swedish Lutheran.
Right.
And I've often wondered if in that statement, at the conclusion, or at the very end of his life, if he's saying something, that he's rediscovering, you know, the depths of what he once had known or something. I don't know. But that's a possibility. But the thing that intrigues me is his mysticism, which seems to me a point of real contact for us today. That's the very dimension that's been missing so largely in our scientific rational approach to faith. It's been discussed in many different ways here, and maybe it's at that point he can be a real help in terms of the inward journey, the whole resurgence of interest in mysticism, really, and I.
Because he's asking more than intellectual assent to a carefully worked out, you know, system of doctrines.
Yeah.
He's asking for a lot more to that. That faith isn't just a matter of assent to certain, you know, teachings, if you like. And that if you sort of make your assent to these, then you disqualifies you for, you know, being, quote, Christian with this. And Hammarskjöld takes that, you know, from the opposite, and he just sort of rejects this. Well, God, this isn't even, you know, viable for him. He says it has to come from the inside first. And one has to come to this on the basis of his own pilgrimage, wherever that might lead, and the risks that are involved with the inner, you know, journey. Because they can lead you off in all sorts of different directions. You can get up in theosophy, and you can get up, you know, in all sorts of different things. And I think, you know, what you say for today, I think this is true, because one reason some of, for instance, the Asian cults, and I think sometimes some of the other things in spirituality that we find popular in America today are reactions against much of the quote, scientific, rationalist kind of approach of the 1960s. And some people say, well, look at where, you know, rationalism and the scientific approach led us into pollution, into war, you know, political corruption, and all the rest of these things. So they're not by, you know, a large number of people, but there has been a swing back. I don't think there's any question to this. And I found this in especially the popularity of some Asian cults and the return of mysticism also. And the danger, obviously, is the risk of getting off, you know, way out somewhere. But I think, on the other hand, things, for instance, like the growing popularity of transcendental meditation is a symptom of the fact that a lot of people aren't finding answers where other answers had been before.
I just heard Walter Camp's chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at Santa Barbara, UC, University of California, Santa Barbara, a couple weeks ago. And this past year, he was describing to us that he's been really caught up in monasticism.
I'm gonna think.
The whole matter of mysticism, really. And he said his reasons for this is he's responsible for kind of keeping current on the current trends in theology in America. And he said what's happened is that the young, as you said, have become terribly enamored of Eastern religions, only to find it's very difficult, as he put it, to be a Buddhist in Pasadena.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And getting caught up in that crunch,
yeah,
have discovered the rich heritage of Christian mysticism, which is throughout our history. And in rediscovering that, have and that's where I think possibly Hammersholt.
If I was the author, this is just a casual impression right now. I haven't got the book yet. If I would substitute Bonhoeffer for that man,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
there, because Bonhoeffer was positive. You know, he,
yeah,
was a man under stress.
Yeah.
He was close to power. He spoke up.
Yes.
He had great faith, and to me, Bonhoeffer is more of a positive example than Doug Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld did a lot in the secular world, and he had to, and like the author you were saying, he had to keep his own private philosophy and theology to himself, just like a president of the United States, a lonely man in a position of power. But Bonhoeffer was able to, you know, bring this all out, you know, convert the prisoners around him and everything, and he had his, I guess he came into prison with his philosophy of life already worked out. And to me, he would have been more of the example than Hammarskjöld there.
Yeah. I should have mentioned one other criteria that McLennan uses. He wanted to choose examples from people who were not at all identified with what we would call being professional theologians. He wanted to take them from everyday life, more everyday life. But I'm sure Bonhoeffer certainly would qualify. And of course, Bonhoeffer wasn't a full-time theologian. He was, you know, very active in many things besides the classroom. So,
he was certainly involved in the secular world.
Oh, very much. Really, there's a big argument, you know, it's never going to be settled how secular, you know, he was.
I'm wondering if in moving from biography to theology, we're moving towards something which becomes normative. It struck me when you asked your leading question about Dr. Hammarskjöld, because I found in myself a strong inclination to want to say yes to his biography without necessarily saying yes to something that would be in some sense normative for me. I think you confront here the uniqueness of each individual's existence and his own way of relating to the mystery of existence or to God himself. And I'm wondering if in McClendon's system here, or his movement, whether there is a sense in moving towards something which becomes normative.
Hmm. Well, McClendon thinks there is. That's his point, that there is something normative in the life of each of these men, which should serve us, you know, as examples, you know, for us today. And I'm just wondering with Hammarskjöld, because he keeps his distance, you know, from institutional Christianity by a long shot. I like the idea that he's probably best understood as a Unitarian, in a sense of dedication to service, to duty, selflessness. He might fit in very well there, but, you know, how much of the Christian tradition, of the old mystical tradition is, you know, involved there too, because you go to the mystics and you're a long ways, you know, away from institutional, you know, Christianity. I think there's a healthy kind of polarity, if you like, there. That comes out because some of the people that I have studied are so wrapped up in institutional Christianity that it simply becomes stifling. It's the idea that somehow, you know, at the final judgment, St. Peter is going to stand there with a clipboard and have sort of a checklist and to see how you qualify, how you stand on this doctrine or that doctrine. If you get a 75 or a 98, you'll pass. And, you know, well, up to a certain point, there have to be, there has to be norms. I mean, Christianity isn't, you know, a universal kind of religion which embraces all things for all men under all conditions at all times. To be sure, you want to protect it against erosion. On the other hand, the mystic approach, I think, is a very healthy and necessary antidote
Well, the Hartford statements are clear statements on the part of American theologians that we're moving towards, again, a reassertion of the transcendence of God. Which would seem to me at this point fits in nicely with the mystical dimension of Hammersholt.
And what I think is wrong, if you like, or certainly dangerous, is when somebody blows a whistle and says it has to be just this, it has to be just that. I suppose some people just can't live with, you know, moving in this direction. But Hammersholt is a good example of a man who couldn't live with the institutional church. I suppose it's one example. The Swedish Lutheran Church is not exactly, you know, dynamic. and he went through the you know, when he got into graduate school, the secular universities obviously were not exactly hospitable to, you know, organized Christianity. As I found at the University of Wisconsin, I just wasn't ready for it myself, and it really hit the fan there. And he never, you know, sort of came back all the way. But I think he came to a different kind of maturity that I find rather, you know, attractive, in the sense that he didn't expect final, you know, sort of man-made kind of answers for the great questions that he had been facing. But he was ready to run the risk of a leap into faith, and wherever that might take him. We don't know the final answer because, you know, he didn't write his final answer because he died before, you know, he had time to retire and reflect on these things. But in that sense, I think there might be something. Yes?
I don't know what you mean by normative.
You brought it up,
though. Various mean various things.
Yeah, but then I don't know what you mean. What did you mean?
Well, what I meant by it is something that now applies to me. That is, this was apparently Hammersholt's theology. That means it should be something useful for me, normative for me. It should be a path that I follow. Normative in that sense. Moving away from the uniqueness of the individual towards some kind of common application, applicability.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And I guess I sense some danger in that, because I really want to affirm the human. You know, I want to give Hammersholt his freedom, because he's coming out of a whole different bag than I am.
Right.
And I want to really respect the wrestling that he did, and the kinds of tentative solutions and answers he may have come to, without saying that's where it's at for me too. You know, I may not be able to get as far as he did, or as far as Bonhoeffer did, or somebody else. Or I might be able to move more toward Christian certitude, or whatever.
Well, it seems to me that one thing that, looking at Hammersholt's life, I think it's a good choice. I haven't read it, but we're so used to looking, I think, lay people, used to looking at theologians as models for living, and here's someone that the people were not even aware of his Christianity, and yet lived that life that of service that we could emulate. And then I think that also one thing that we've been kind of wrestling with in our group and church was, because a person does something and we want to follow that, do we have to accept all of him, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that to be able to see somebody that we did not state outwardly, I am a Christian and I am doing this because I'm a Christian, that we can follow him. Or look to him as an example, but see that there is an example of living himself coming out like Billy Graham, you know, and then you look at Billy Graham and see his expensive clothes and
things. See what?
See his expensive clothes and his house, you know, because, you know, he's making all that money, you know.
Well, that's fine. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I like what you're saying very much, and I have the sense that McClendon is saying we're trying to move beyond this, looking at these people as exemplars,
right,
as models for our life. He said we've been doing that for some time, but we can do even more than that. We can now go from biography to not just ethical or models, but to theology. And that's what I'm raising some questions about, and they're very tentative in my own head. I like what you say about using people in this way, because with fully respect, I think their life situation. I'm a little worried at this early stage about trying to get to some kind of a theology which might be in some sense normative.
Yeah, well, this is a pioneer book, and this is what it's kind of fun about the book, because it's a real breakthrough. And as I say, myself, I have to confess my own bias here. I'm very fond of biography. My dissertation was a biography, and I always think that history is people. And if it isn't people, if it's just forces and movements and trends and everything, you know, forget it. But it's individuals doing things and reacting under situations. And I like the kind of personal approach, which I think may well, you know, continue, because even in your thing with humanistic psychology, it's the same kind of reaction against, you know, patterns and trends and laws and, you know, all these sorts of things, which I think is a very exciting sort of thing. And it's a risk, very risky, because, I'm sure in formal psychology circles, these people are considered sort of second-class citizens because it isn't scientific any longer. But I like to think of Hammarskjöld as a good antidote to many of these, and an example of a very significant and important, you know, public figure who had enormous power and capacity, who did take these kind of questions, you know, very, very, very seriously, and raise and serves, I think, as an example, or if you like, a model. And I'd agree with Margaret, we don't have to take, you know, become Hammarskjöldians, I suppose, because he wasn't offering, you know, a complete, you know, religious faith. He was offering one personal interpretation and expression of this.
I'm just thinking, in terms of your formula on the board, Hammarskjöld would appear to have really known solitude in his life. Surely knew hospitality. The only thing we're quibbling about is whether he held illusions or moved fully to prayer.
I would think that some of the things in Markings are marvelous prayers.
I would.
One you quoted a moment ago.
Yeah.
For everything that has been, thanks. For everything that will be, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great prayer.
Right. But it seems to me that we're really uncertain at the third level.
There was one quote in Markings that was in the preface. Could you just look in there? I think it's about within the last page. Something about one quote of Hammarskjöld, that the road to holiness is paved through something.
The way of action.
Pardon?
The way of action.
Yeah.
The way of action, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I thought that was more significant in there than anything that I've written the whole Markings here.
Right, yeah, exactly. In our age, the road to holiness necessarily passes through the world of action.
That's pure Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And I must say, for myself, the idea of he acted as if it was true was the key for me that made it exciting. Because, yeah, that's all I can say from my own personal sense of or convictions. So you act as if, because if you wait for all the answers to come in before you act, you're never going to get them. But you go ahead and act as if.
Which could be normative.
Could be, yes, right. And
in that sense, that's where I think I can get the point of contact. In that sense, and with the inwardness. I mean, here's a man who became disenchanted with the organized church. Surely we have, in America, that's the mood of the land, too, in many ways. People disenchanted with the organized church, especially segments of it. There are points of real contact.
Good. Okay, we don't have to stay till the bell rings.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I hope you. We'll try King tomorrow. That's a different ball game. That would be fun, too.
Yeah.